Today is Wednesday, May 20th, 2026. This is your geopolitics briefing for Briefing Desk. In the next 35 to 37 minutes, we'll cover Ukraine's largest drone operation of the war, nearly 600 aircraft striking military-industrial targets around Moscow, the diplomatic complications caused by a Russian strike on a Chinese-owned vessel in the Black Sea on the eve of Putin's Beijing summit, and a CSIS panel's conclusion that 35 years of denuclearization-first policy on the Korean Peninsula has fundamentally failed. Let's begin with the most consequential development of the week, a dramatic and reciprocal escalation between Ukraine and Russia that culminated in the largest single Ukrainian drone operation since the war began. The week of May 14th through 20th produced what analysts are calling the most intense exchange of aerial strikes since the war's opening phase. Both sides deployed record-scale arsenals. Both sides claimed proportionate justification. And by the end of the week, the war had reached into Moscow itself, in a way that is now impossible for the Kremlin to conceal from its own population. We need to start with what Russia did, because Ukraine's response is inseparable from it. According to the military show, Russia deployed 675 drones and 56 missiles in an overnight attack on Kyiv between May 14th and May 15th. This was not a routine bombardment. The munition mix included Iskander ballistic missiles, Kinzhal aeroballistic missiles, and notably, S-400 surface-to-air systems repurposed for land attack. That last category is significant. The S-400 is a defensive system being used offensively, which the same source cited as evidence of a growing shortage in Russia's dedicated precision land attack inventory. In other words, Russia is now drawing on its air defense stockpiles to sustain its offensive strike campaign. Ukraine's air defenses intercepted 652 drones, 12 Iskander and S-400 missiles, and 29 KH-101 cruise missiles per the military show. But interception is never perfect. The munitions that broke through struck 11 residential buildings in Kyiv and 50 across Ukraine more broadly. At least 24 people were killed and at least 48 injured. Three of the dead were children. The youngest was a 12-year-old girl. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky, speaking after the attack, made a pointed observation. At least one of the KH-101 cruise missiles that struck a Kyiv residential building had been manufactured in the second quarter of 2026. That is not a historical stockpile. That is a missile built this year, this spring, still being delivered to Ukrainian civilians. Zelensky cited this as evidence that existing international sanctions are insufficient to disrupt Russian arms production, per the military show. Ukrainian Foreign Minister Andriy Sybiha called for a UN Security Council session specifically focused on civilian targeting, and the context for that demand is stark. The Office of the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, as cited by the military show, had already recorded 15,578 Ukrainian civilians killed and 43,352 injured as of March 31st of this year, with verified figures acknowledged as likely undercounting the actual totals. Ukraine's military response came within hours. On May 15th, Ukraine launched long-range drones reaching approximately 1,000 kilometers into Russian territory, targeting the Ryazan oil refinery, one of Russia's largest processing facilities, with a peak annual processing capacity of more than 17.1 million tons. The facility sits roughly 450 kilometers from Ukraine's border and 180 kilometers southeast of Moscow, according to the military show. Civilians in the area reported explosions beginning around 2 in the morning local time and continuing until at least 5 a.m., per Ukraine Today, as cited in the same report. This was described as the ninth successful strike on that facility in 2025 alone. A November 2025 strike had brought it to a complete halt. Building on that pattern of sustained targeting, Ukraine has been systematically degrading Russia's energy infrastructure with a consistency and precision that was not possible earlier in the war. Additional confirmed Ukrainian strikes on May 15th included a Bereav B-200 Eltar aircraft and Ka-27 helicopter in Yeisk, a Tor-M2 air defense system in Russian-occupied Luhansk, a Panzer S-1 in Crimea, a Redut 2 U.S. communication system, and a dry cargo ship carrying ammunition, the last two confirmed directly by Zelensky per the military show. Moscow Regional Governor Sergei Sobyanin separately acknowledged that 5 Ukrainian drones were intercepted over Moscow itself, per the same source. On May 13th, 2 days before this exchange, Ukraine's general staff had already confirmed drone strikes on the Yaroslavsky oil refinery's primary processing facility and the Astrakhansky gas processing plant in Astrakhan, causing a fire there, along with a port strike in Taman targeting Russian oil exports. Reuters reported on May 13th that Russian crude oil production fell by 460,000 barrels per day in April compared to the same month in 2025. The New Voice of Ukraine reported that Russian production has fallen to its lowest level since 2009, and United 24 Media reported that Russian oil shipments from Baltic Sea ports are down 31%. All of this was cited by the military show. But all of that was a prelude to what happened on May 17th. On that day, according to United 24 Media, Ukraine launched a drone swarm of nearly 600 aircraft targeting Moscow and military industrial facilities in the Moscow region. The operation extended across nearly 24 hours. Russia's defense ministry, as cited by the Kyiv Independent, claimed its air defenses intercepted over 1,054 Ukrainian drones, 8 guided bombs, and 2 missiles, a figure notably revised upward from an initial claim of 556. Russian military blogger Alexander Kotz acknowledged, per the transcript, that for the first time the number of downed long-range drones had exceeded 1,000, averaging 44 per hour. The targets Ukraine selected tell a story about strategic intent. The Security Service of Ukraine, the SBU, claimed responsibility for strikes on several high-value industrial facilities, all according to The Guardian, as cited by the military show. These included the Elma Zelenograd complex, approximately 30 kilometers northwest of central Moscow, a manufacturer of electronics and microelectronics used in weapons systems. Also struck was the Angstrom Enterprise in Zelenograd, a manufacturer of microprocessors, semiconductors, and microelectronics, and the Raduga Machine Building Design Bureau in Dubna, the facility responsible for building missile and cruise missile systems. These are not fuel depots or warehouses, these are the production nodes of Russia's weapons manufacturing ecosystem. More importantly, Ukraine also struck the Moscow oil refinery, described as one of Russia's 10 largest, with annual throughput of 11 million tons and supplying approximately 40% of the Moscow region's fuel. Footage of damage and smoke was published by Telegram channel Astra, per the military show. The Solnechnogorsk fuel loading station was separately geolocated and confirmed struck per the same footage. The civilian disruption was significant. Nearly 100 flights were delayed or canceled at Vnukovo Airport, and approximately 200 at Sheremetyevo Airport, according to the Kyiv Independent, as cited by the military show. For Muscovites, this was no longer a distant war. Ukraine also extended this operation far beyond Moscow. Ukraine's commander of unmanned systems forces, Robert Brovdy, confirmed via Facebook that drones traveled nearly 1,000 kilometers to strike a Russian Project 10410 Svetlyak patrol boat near Kaspisk in Dagestan, the fourth Russian vessel destroyed by Ukrainian drones in May alone, per Euromaidan Press, as cited by the military show. Partisan group Atesh published on Telegram on May 17th a claim that its agents had disrupted communication towers in the Putilkovo, Komunarka, and Domodedovo areas of the Moscow region, stating those facilities housed electronic warfare modules coordinating Russian air defense units, per the military show. If accurate, this suggests Ukraine's drone campaign was coordinated with ground-level sabotage inside Russian territory. The SBU also confirmed strikes against Russian air defense assets at Belbek Air Base in occupied Crimea, including a Pantsir S-2 system, a radar hangar associated with S-400 systems, an air traffic control tower, and a ground control station for Orion and Forpost drones, per United 24 Media as cited in the same source. One day before the Moscow strikes, Zelensky separately confirmed that a Bereav B-200 amphibious aircraft at Yesik military airfield on the Azov Sea coast had been destroyed in a strike valued at $40 million, with satellite imagery confirming the result. The Kremlin's response to all of this is itself revealing. The Moscow city government passed a law banning publication of information about Ukrainian drone strikes without official permission, reported by the Kyiv Independent on May 13th, per the military show. That is a censorship measure targeting the war's domestic visibility, not the war itself. In the aftermath of the May 17th strikes, Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov stated publicly that there is currently no threat to Russia's existence in comments to Russian propagandist Pavel Zarubin, per War and Politics 24. Russian Foreign Ministry spokeswoman Maria Zakharova claimed the attacks were funded by the European Union, a claim for which no independent confirmation was provided. Social media videos from the Moscow region showed residents expressing visible alarm, according to War and Politics 24. The information environment inside Russia is fracturing. To understand how Ukraine achieved this, it helps to look at the scale and speed of Ukrainian drone production. Ukraine is currently producing approximately 200 long-range drones per day, according to United 24 Media, as cited by the military show. The inventory includes several distinct platforms. The Flamingo is a drone-missile hybrid capable of carrying a warhead of up to approximately 1,100 kilograms. The Fluorine Monophosphide 1 has a range exceeding 1,000 kilometers, with a warhead of 105 kilograms. The Fluorine Monophosphide 2 has a range of 200 kilometers, with a warhead of 158 kilograms. On May 11th, Ukraine announced a joint drone production partnership with Germany targeting development of systems with a range of 1,500 kilometers, which would meaningfully extend Ukraine's reach deeper into Russian territory, per the military show. The Center for European Policy Analysis reported that drones are now used against 80-85% of Ukraine's frontline targets, and that Ukraine plans to manufacture 8 million drones in 2026. Ukraine's defense ministry reported that more than 200 companies are working on AI-related military technologies, with over 300 AI developments registered on the Brave 1 platform as of April. Approximately 200 Ukrainian drone experts are working with Gulf nations, including Saudi Arabia and Qatar, a development we'll return to when we discuss Iran. U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio, speaking to Fox News on May 14th aboard Air Force One en route to China, stated directly that the Ukrainian armed forces are, in his words, quote, the strongest, most powerful armed forces in all of Europe, just to be clear, right now. He attributed this to battlefield experience and hybrid asymmetric warfare development, per the military show. Rubio also stated that Russia is losing between 15,000 and 20,000 soldiers per month, and that Russian fatalities are running five times as many soldiers a month as Ukraine's. The Kiel Institute's Ukraine support tracker, cited by the military show, recorded nearly $134 billion in U.S. aid and $241 billion in European aid to Ukraine, with a further $208 billion in European aid committed but not yet allocated. Those are not marginal contributions. They represent a sustained and substantial investment by Western governments in Ukraine's capacity to fight. Hanna Naote, director of the Eurasia Nonproliferation Program at the James Martin Center for Nonproliferation Studies, told the Kyiv Independent, as cited by the military show, that Ukraine has clearly gained an ability to inflict pain on Russia in a way it could not previously, and that this ability is not going away. Military observer Oleksandr Kovalenko, affiliated with the Information Resistance Organization and quoted by Ukrinform, said Ukraine had been systematically degrading Russian air defenses since 2022 and was now in a position to, in his words, shatter those defenses. While the battlefield escalation dominates headlines, a parallel and in some ways equally significant story is unfolding inside Russia itself. A convergence of signals from multiple sources, including Russian parliamentarians, independent analysts, and economic data, points to deepening internal stress within the Russian state, even as the Kremlin maintains its public posture of strategic confidence. Russian Parliament member Renat Sulmanov stated publicly that Russia cannot afford to continue its current military campaign, citing official figures placing defense and security expenditures at 40% of the federal budget, per Jason J. Smart. He warned that the war's conclusion, whenever it comes, would require the reintegration of approximately 1 million soldiers returning from the front, including employment, salaries, and social adaptation programs. And he stated clearly that the Kremlin currently has no plan for this. Building on that, a separate statement by the leader of Russia's second-largest political party, made several weeks prior, warned that the Kremlin was facing a moment comparable to 1917 if structural problems were not addressed. Also per Jason J. Smart. That is an extraordinary public statement from an establishment figure in a political environment where dissent is dangerous. Andreas Omland, a policy fellow at the European Policy Institute in Kyiv, assessed for War and Politics 24 that Russia's war-driven economic stimulus, the elevated state weapons orders that he described as producing a Keynesian effect, has now concluded. The short-term growth that war spending generated is fading, and economic and social strain is becoming more visible across Russian society, among ordinary people, business figures, and the political elite alike. Omland assessed that the likelihood of an economic collapse has increased over the past year based on accumulating evidence of systemic stress, though he declined to put a timeline on it. He noted Russia is currently benefiting from elevated oil and gas prices linked to tensions in the Iran conflict as a short-term buffer, but that buffer is contingent on a geopolitical situation that could shift quickly. The human texture of this strain is visible in the details. Russian teachers with 35 to 38 years of service receive approximately $187 per month, with a maximum of $673 per month, depending on location. Berries in Moscow retail at $44 to $55 per kilogram. Russia currently operates international flights to approximately 31 countries, described in the same source as fewer destinations than during the Soviet era. These are the small but accumulated markers of a society under pressure. On the question of political stability, Omland told War and Politics 24 that several international media outlets, citing European intelligence sources, have reported that Putin fears a coup attempt and has strengthened his personal security. He referenced the June 2023 Prigozhin mutiny, assessing that political change nearly occurred at that moment, halted only after Belarusian President Alexander Lukashenko persuaded Prigozhin to stand down. Omland identified fear of a destabilizing reform scenario as the primary factor currently binding regime factions together. In other words, Russian elites stay aligned not because they share a vision for victory, but because none of them want to be the one who loses control of the transition. On the information front, the SVR, Russia's Foreign Intelligence Service, issued a statement attributing the spread of what it characterized as false information on Telegram to Ukrainian funding of domestic channels. Telegram is used by over 60 million people inside Russia as a primary news source, per Jason J. Smart. Omland separately assessed that the Kremlin's restrictions on Russian internet access reflect, in his words, a panicked response, not a controlled information management strategy. On battlefield recruitment, Omland assessed that Russia retains alternatives to general mobilization, primarily financial incentives and selective pressure on specific population groups. But general mobilization is politically difficult to justify in what he characterized as an expansionist rather than defensive war, a claim attributed to Ukrainian Armed Forces information, cited by War and Politics 24, holds that Ukraine is eliminating more Russian troops than Russia is replacing through mobilization. As for diplomacy, Omland characterized Russia's recent peace negotiation statements as negotiation theater. Kremlin spokesman Peskov issued an ultimatum demanding Ukraine withdraw forces not only from Donbas but from remaining portions of the Zaporizhia and Kherson oblasts, an expansion of prior demands. Putin aide Yuri Ushakov stated Russia was withdrawing from trilateral negotiations pending Ukrainian withdrawal from Donbas. European Council President Antonio Costa declared the EU has the potential to negotiate directly with Putin. Putin, for his part, named former German Chancellor Gerhard Schröder as his preferred interlocutor, a candidacy Omland assessed as heavily criticized within the EU. Now to one of the more diplomatically delicate developments of the week, and one that deserves more attention than it has received. In the early hours of Monday, May 18th, Russian forces struck a Chinese-owned commercial vessel, identified as the KSL The Young, with a Shahed loitering munition in Ukrainian waters in the Black Sea, according to a Ukrainian Navy spokesperson cited by Warren Politics 24. The vessel flies the flag of the Marshall Islands but is owned by a Chinese shipowner and crewed by a Chinese crew. The Ukrainian Navy reported no casualties. The timing here is what makes this remarkable. This strike occurred immediately before Putin's planned official visit to Beijing on May 19th and 20th at the invitation of Chinese President Xi Jinping. Russia, the state conducting this visit, had just struck a vessel owned and crewed by the nation it was traveling to meet. The transcript does not include any statement from Chinese authorities regarding the incident or its potential effect on the summit, but the analytical implications are significant. Beijing has carefully maintained a posture of formal neutrality while providing diplomatic cover to Moscow. A Russian missile striking a Chinese commercial vessel in a zone of active hostilities the day before a state visit creates real pressure on Xi Jinping to respond publicly to an incident caused by his putative strategic partner. How Beijing handles this will be worth watching closely in the coming days. Separately, Jason J. Smart reported that Xi Jinping, in a meeting with U.S. President Trump described as occurring several days prior, reportedly indicated that Putin would likely come to regret the invasion of Ukraine. The independent sourcing for that characterization was not detailed in the transcript, but placed alongside the Black Sea incident, it suggests that the Russia-China relationship, which Moscow has presented as a cornerstone of its strategic resilience, may be under more strain than either government publicly acknowledges. Turning now to Iran, where the United States came within hours of a military strike before standing down, and where the standoff over both nuclear talks and Strait of Hormuz security remains unresolved. According to a Truth Social post by President Trump read on the Rubin Report, Trump stated he paused a military operation against Iran after being asked to do so by Qatar's Amir Tamim bin Hamad Al Thani, Saudi Arabia's Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, and UAE President Mohammed bin Zayed Al Nahyan. All three indicated that serious negotiations were underway and that a deal was close. Trump stated he directed Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth and Joint Chiefs Chairman General Daniel Kane to stand down, but remain prepared for what he described as a full, large-scale assault on a moment's notice, if an acceptable deal is not reached. Trump also stated in a clip attributed to Fox News anchor Brett Baier that Chinese President Xi Jinping expressed willingness to help facilitate a deal and said he would like to see the Strait of Hormuz open. The Rubin Report noted, without a named source, that Iran has been losing approximately $500 million per day due to a blockade on oil exports, and that China obtains approximately 13-14% of its oil from Iran. Those figures explain Beijing's interest in an early resolution, which in turn helps explain Xi's reported willingness to play a facilitative role. Iran's negotiating position, per Warren Politics 24, is a 14-point proposal calling for discussions on Strait of Hormuz security in exchange for a long-term ceasefire, with nuclear program talks to follow. The Trump administration's stated position requires nuclear discussions to come first, before any ceasefire. These two sequencing demands are currently irreconcilable, and that gap is what keeps this standoff unresolved. Representative R. O. Khanna, shown on the Rubin Report, stated that Iran's new leadership, identified as Mojtaba Khamenei, is more hardline than his predecessor and is seeking to develop nuclear weapons, citing enriched uranium. The program noted, without a named source, that Khamenei has not been seen publicly in weeks. There is also a domestic American legal dimension here. Under the U.S. War Powers Act, the Trump administration would be required to seek congressional authorization after 60 days of hostilities. The U.S.-Israel conflict involving Iran and Lebanon was placed at approximately 73 to 74 days at the time of the Warren Politics 24 commentary, meaning congressional authorization requirements are already operative. Some Republican members of Congress, as well as Democrats, have signaled willingness to enforce that requirement, per the same source. Trump separately stated that the United States had left Iranian bridges and electrical infrastructure intact, but retained the ability to destroy them within 2 days. A deliberate signal of escalatory headroom, a way of saying the pause is not a surrender of capability. More importantly for the broader regional picture, Warren Politics 24 characterized Zelensky's visits to Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and the UAE as serving a dual purpose, positioning Ukrainian drone technology as a less costly alternative to U.S.-supplied air defense systems at a moment when U.S. intercept missile stocks are described as significantly depleted. The presence of approximately 200 Ukrainian drone experts working with Gulf states is not incidental. It is part of a deliberate Ukrainian effort to build new strategic relationships through demonstrated capability. Shifting now to the Korean Peninsula, where a CSIS panel discussion this week delivered one of the most direct challenges to established U.S. foreign policy doctrine that we've seen in some time. The panel centered on a foreign affairs paper by Dr. Victor Cha titled The Cold Peace, and its central conclusion was blunt, insisting on complete denuclearization as a precondition for negotiations has foreclosed diplomatic progress for 35 years. The framework is not working, and continuing to apply it is not a neutral choice. It is a choice with consequences. Ambassador Joseph Yoon, former Special Representative for North Korea Policy, told the panel that insisting on denuclearization is not going to get anywhere. He identified a recurring and destructive tension in U.S. policymaking between denuclearization as a stated diplomatic goal and what he described as an emotional goal of regime change. He cited former Vice President Dick Cheney's reported 2002 or 2003 statement, "We don't negotiate with evil, we defeat it," as an example of how such postures undermine the credibility of American negotiators at the table. When the people behind your negotiators want to end the regime, no negotiated deal on nuclear weapons can hold. Adam Farrar, former White House Korea and Mongolia director, was equally direct. Kim Jong-un has no interest whatsoever in denuclearization and feels increasingly secure, primarily because of North Korea's deepening relationship with Russia. The war in Ukraine has, paradoxically, strengthened Kim Jong-un's strategic position by giving him a major power partner that needs his munitions and will provide diplomatic cover in return. Both panelists referenced the 2019 Hanoi summit as an analytical reference point. At Hanoi, North Korea requested the lifting of all UN Security Council sanctions imposed since 2016 in exchange for a freeze limited to the Yongbyon facility. Ambassador Yoon assessed the United States would not have been better or worse off accepting the offer, since the rest of North Korea's program would have continued regardless. Farrar took a harder view. The Hanoi offer was problematic because it would have given North Korea more resources to expand its program outside Yongbyon. The two assessments are not irreconcilable. They both point to the same structural problem, which is that partial deals in this context tend to benefit the party with fewer constraints. Yoon provided useful context on the asymmetry driving North Korea's threat perception. South Korea has a population of approximately 50 million against North Korea's approximately 20 to 25 million. South Korea's per capita GDP is approximately $40,000 against North Korea's figure, estimated at well below $10,000. The disparity is stark. From Pyongyang's perspective, nuclear weapons are not a bargaining chip. They are the equalizer. Yoon identified the 28,500 U.S. troops stationed in Korea, along with B-52 flights, submarine deployments, and aircraft carrier visits, as the primary inducements North Korea would seek in any negotiation. These are the assets that represent existential threat from Pyongyang's view. Farrar said Kim Jong-un's primary desire is to be treated as an equal by the United States. And he assessed that a framework framing discussions as addressing mutual security concerns between equals could go further than generally assumed, per CSIS. That is a significant shift from 35 years of policy that has framed North Korea as a state requiring transformation rather than accommodation. Both Yoon and Farrar agreed that the Trump administration currently values stability on the Korean Peninsula above engagement, with no concerted policy effort behind the president's periodic expressions of willingness to meet Kim Jong-un. Farrar noted that a South Korean government led by Democratic Party leader Lee Jae-myung would be more receptive to a negotiating framework involving trade-offs than a conservative administration would be. Let's move to the European Security Architecture Panel, held this week in Yerevan, Armenia, moderated by Patrick Winter, diplomatic editor of The Guardian. The forum, hosted by the Observer Research Foundation, addressed a fundamental question in the current geopolitical environment. In a fragmenting international order, should smaller states seek shelter under a major power, or chart independent courses? Croatia's State Secretary for Europe offered a concrete answer, rooted in her country's own choices. Croatia ranks among the top 10 contributors of military assistance to Ukraine, as measured by GDP ratio, she stated. She endorsed continued EU sanctions, referencing a package she described as the 20th. She also cited a 90 billion euro EU loan figure in the context of Ukraine support. Perhaps most strikingly, she noted that Croatia's approximately 15,000 seafarers are currently constrained within the Strait of Hormuz, making the Iran standoff not a distant geopolitical abstraction, but a direct economic reality for Croatian working families. Croatia has also built an LNG terminal on the island of KRK near the port of Rijeka and sits on four European transport corridors, investments that reflect a deliberate strategy of energy and logistical diversification. Armenia's former ambassador to Washington offered a different but equally instructive account. He described the Prime Minister's February 7, 2025 meeting with the U.S. Vice President, held just 4 days after the January 20th inauguration, as part of a security and peace agenda, and confirmed that Armenia and Azerbaijan have initialed a peace agreement in Washington in the presence of the U.S. President. He cited polling showing significant public aspiration toward EU membership, and noted the Armenian parliament adopted a resolution initiating an EU integration process the previous year. For a country that spent decades inside the Russian security orbit, this trajectory is notable. North Macedonia's representative added another dimension. NATO accession for his country required a constitutionally mandated name change achieved approximately 5 to 6 years prior. He cited 14 unimplemented decisions from the European Court of Human Rights in Strasbourg regarding a Macedonian minority in Bulgaria, a reminder that European integration processes carry their own unresolved tensions. A policy analyst at the forum described the South Caucasus as having multiple influencers rather than a single hegemon. He characterized the current geopolitical model as a la carte, states assembling security, technology, and diplomatic relationships from different partners, producing what he called overlapping dependencies. He assessed Azerbaijan as having achieved a degree of strategic autonomy through its energy resources and allied relations with Turkey, but noted this has not yet produced regional strategic autonomy across all three South Caucasus states. Separately, at the same forum, Romanian Senator Corlatian made a point that deserves wider attention. Russian drones crossing the Romanian-Ukrainian border have struck targets on Romanian territory. Romania is a NATO member state. He noted the Parliamentary Assembly of the Council of Europe voted unanimously on March 15th to recommend Russia's exclusion from the Council of Europe. Romania has a population of approximately 20 million, including an ethnic Hungarian community of approximately 1.2 million, represented through a constitutionally mandated parliamentary seat. The presence of Russian munitions on Romanian soil is not a peripheral detail. It is the alliance's Article 5 obligations made concrete. Before we close, a few developments on the periphery that nonetheless carry weight. On Ukrainian domestic politics, former Ukrainian presidential office chief Andriy Yermak was released from pretrial detention after bail of 140 million hryvnias was posted on his behalf, reported by Suspilne as cited by Warren Politics 24. Investigative outlets SKEMI reported approximately 200 individual payments into the high anti-corruption court account, with the total reaching over 154 million hryvnias. Yermak stated publicly that the case was conducted under political pressure. His defense team is preparing an appeal. Specific charges were not detailed in the available reporting. On a separate legal front, a federal jury rejected Elon Musk's claims against OpenAI co-founders Sam Altman and Greg Brockman after less than 2 hours of deliberations, per Fox Business, as cited by the Rubin Report. Jurors found unanimously that breach of charitable trust claims were filed outside the statute of limitations. Musk stated he would appeal to the Ninth Circuit. And finally, the Pentagon released the first batch of declassified documents related to unidentified aerial phenomena, a total of 162 files including State Department telegrams, FBI documents, and NASA transcripts of pilot spaceflights, per Warren Politics 24. Former President Barack Obama stated in a cited interview that extraterrestrial life exists, but that he has not personally seen evidence of it and that no underground facilities housing such evidence exist at Area 51 to his knowledge. Taken together, this week's developments point towards several themes worth holding in mind as events continue to unfold. Ukraine has crossed a threshold in its ability to strike deep inside Russia, not symbolically, but strategically, targeting the production nodes that sustain Russian military capacity. Russia's internal pressures are accumulating in ways that Russian officials themselves are now articulating publicly. China's relationship with Russia is under strain it has not publicly acknowledged. And on both the Korean Peninsula and in the Iran standoff, long-standing American policy frameworks are being tested and, in some cases, found wanting. Thank you for listening. That's your geopolitics briefing for today from Briefing Desk. We'll be back tomorrow with the latest developments as they emerge.